It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Melissa Block. JPMorgan Chase is acting contrite after admitting that it lost at least $2 billion in a hedging strategy that went terribly wrong. The announcement late yesterday sent the bank's shares tumbling, and today it suffered a credit downgrade from one of the major ratings companies. Meanwhile, regulators have begun looking into what happened, and as NPR's Jim Zaroli reports, there were calls today for tighter restrictions on the kind of trades the bank conducted.
It was the kind of ardent mea culpa that's rarely heard on Wall Street. Jamie Dimon, the revered chief executive of JPMorgan Chase, told analysts late yesterday that the company had screwed up. A unit of the bank that's supposed to manage risk had made a big bet on its loan portfolio, he said, and the bet had backfired.
We have more work to do, but it's obvious at this point that there are many errors, sloppiness, and bad judgment.
The admission yesterday was especially embarrassing for Dimon because he had recently denied there were any problems. He admitted yesterday that he looked into the bad trades only after questions were raised by Bloomberg and the Wall Street Journal. Bank analyst Nancy Bush, contributing editor to SNL Financial, found that especially surprising.
And as somebody who has known Mr. Dimon for quite a long time, I went, holy mackerel, what are you talking about? Because how did you not know about this? How could you not have known that this was going on?
Today, the bank's big loss was the talk of the financial world. JPMorgan Chase was one of the few major banking companies to emerge from the financial crisis with its reputation intact. Now that reputation is in tatters. Andrew Barber is CEO of Waverly Advisors.
I think that this is definitely a kick in the teeth for the American financial sector because JPMorgan was regarded as one of the best run of the major banks, and its reputation being tarnished reflects poorly on the financial sector in general.
The bank's losses amount to at least $2 billion and could be even higher. That's not a crushing blow for a company the size of JPMorgan Chase, and even with the losses, it's likely to finish this quarter with a nice profit. But John Makin, research fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, says it raises troubling questions about the U.S. banking business.
Here's this story about JPMorgan having taking a big loss, which they can manage, but it makes you wonder, are others taking such big losses? Just at a time when the European financial system is under heavy stress.
Makin says the losses are especially disturbing because they come so soon after the 2008 financial crisis, when many major banks had to be bailed out.
Here we are, 3 years later, still with some suggestion that these institutions are still taking fairly large risks.
Makin says what's happened at JPMorgan Chase underscores the need to implement the so-called Volcker Rule, which would bar big banks from trading their own funds. The rule is supposed to take effect in July, but banks won't have to fully comply with it for 2 years. JPMorgan Chase insisted yesterday that the failed trades were part of a hedging strategy and the Volcker Rule wouldn't have applied to them. But Michigan Senator Carl Levin disagreed. Levin spoke on CNBC this afternoon.
It is clearly inconsistent with what we did, which is to say to these big banks, you cannot take these big proprietary bets. You cannot bet on the direction of the economy. You can hedge, but this was not a hedge.
Just what kind of trade this was is still unclear, and there are a lot of questions about exactly what happened. Today came word that the Securities and Exchange Commission has begun an investigation. Whatever the outcome, the image of JPMorgan Chase as a bank where this sort of thing couldn't happen has been dealt a crushing blow. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
Joining us now is Stephanie Rule. She's a correspondent with Bloomberg TV's Inside Track. She's been covering the story since it first started to develop back in early April. Welcome, Stephanie.
Thank you for having me. We have been working on this story for over a month now. And, you know, it was a big surprise to us last night when J.P. Morgan's Jamie Dimon did come out with a very big mea culpa and, you know, saying, I'm sorry, we do have egg on our face. When, you know, when we reached out to them 5-6 weeks ago, as the story was developing, they were very clear that this was merely a hedging strategy, which really just means they're offsetting risk. Where they are extending loans, they implement a strategy where they're offsetting taking that risk. And a bank as big as J.P. Morgan is extending a massive amount of loans. And they were very clear a month ago saying this is just a hedging strategy, nothing more. And all the noise being created is simply a tempest in a teapot. Well, fast forward 5 weeks, and that does not seem to be the case. And the $2 billion loss could potentially be just the beginning. And obviously, those of us inside the business, inside the markets, are very focused. But we're actually getting quite a bit of focus from those outside.
Now, Stephanie, I want to stop you for a second because we need to understand the anatomy of what's happened. Tell us about the man known as the London Whale who is at the heart of these trades.
Bruno Ixell. So Bruno Ixell sits in a part of the bank known as the Chief Investment Office. And as J.P. Morgan will tell you, what this area does, they take excess capital that the firm brings in from deposits and they reinvest it for a return.
And normally it's supposed to sort of protect the bank. It's not supposed to be a place where they sort of play around with money for short-term profit.
And especially in highly structured areas. So just to put it in a little bit more context, you know, as we worked on this story, I was speaking to someone in a restaurant, not in the business, and I simply said, you know, what do you think of J.P. Morgan and American banks? And, you know, he said to me, you know, after 2008, I don't feel good about any bank, but J.P. Morgan is the biggest. You know, he said J.P. Morgan is the best. Jamie Dimon, he is the American bank CEO you trust, you rely on. He's a straight-talking guy. And I asked this gentleman, I said, well, what would you say if I said, well, what if J.P. Morgan is taking that excess capital and investing it for a return, not necessarily for treasuries? You know, if you invest in treasuries, you're getting almost nothing, so they are searching for a yieldier product. And he said to me, well, that would make some sense. And I said, well, what if the product they were investing in was highly structured, was in the credit derivative space, the space that Warren Buffett himself has called a weapon of mass destruction? And this gentleman said to me, absolutely not. Following 2008, following what Americans had to go through with banks, we wouldn't see that movie all over again. And, you know, apparently that does seem to be the case.
So, Stephanie, we've talked about what a colossal mistake this is, $2 billion and counting. But put it in perspective, you know, to J.P. Morgan Chase's profits. Is this just undermining their confidence or in just this company? What's the thing to look for here?
Well, that's really an excellent point, because if you think about J.P. Morgan and the massive size of of the firm, you would think $2 billion, it really is a drop in the bucket. But that's what's interesting about Mr. Dimon coming out to speak now. One would think a man of his stature would not want to make a public statement, a mea culpa over $2 billion. A firm of that size, they could figure out a way to work that through the system, which is leading many of us to believe $2 billion could be just the beginning. And Dimon himself said it could be a rocky road ahead, and there could be more losses than this. And much like the credit crisis of 2008, these type of credit products can get very illiquid very quickly. And when that happens, people in the business say you're hedged and wedged. You might not be able to get out. So that $2 billion could turn into $3, $4, or $5 very quickly. And we need to keep an eye on it.
That's Stephanie Ruhl. She's a correspondent with Bloomberg TV's Inside Track. Stephanie, thanks for explaining it to us.
Thank you. Happy Mother's Day.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Melissa Block. Mitt Romney is from Michigan. He won the Republican primary there, and he says he hopes to win the state again in the fall. But Romney has very publicly opposed the government bailout of the auto industry. In 2008, when it was clear Chrysler and GM were in big trouble, he wrote a New York Times op-ed that ran under the headline, "Let Detroit Go Bankrupt." The government stepped in, the companies still did file for bankruptcy, and today the companies are back, making cars and making money. And now, candidate Romney says it was his idea all along. NPR's Tamara Keith reports on the controversy over who should get credit.
Earlier this week, in an appearance on WEWS-TV in Cleveland, Mitt Romney said something that has raised more than a few eyebrows.
I pushed the idea of a managed bankruptcy, and finally when that was done, and help was given, the companies got back on their feet. So I'll take a lot of credit for the fact that this industry's come back.
It's true that in his 2008 editorial, Romney suggested the idea of a managed bankruptcy. He says it was a mistake for the Bush administration and later the Obama administration to give the automakers money before they went into bankruptcy. Here's Romney further explaining his vision in a CNBC-sponsored debate in November 2011.
My plan we would have had a private sector bailout with the right, private sector restructuring and bankruptcy with the private sector guiding the direction, as opposed to what we had with government playing its heavy hand.
Frankly, what we told ourselves at General Motors was, we're sure he's a good governor, but he doesn't know what he's talking about in this instance.
Bob Lutz is a retired vice chairman of GM. He's the author of the book Car Guys and Bean Counters, The Battle for the Soul of American Business. And he was at GM at the time of the crisis. He says he and other executives wrote off Romney's idea of a private sector restructuring for one simple reason.
What he conveniently forgets is that there was zero liquidity in the country. There was no way to fund a private Chapter 11, even though, believe me, General Motors really tried to get private debt financing or organize a private Chapter 11, but there was no money to do it.
Ultimately, the companies did go through managed bankruptcies, managed by the government with taxpayer dollars. In the months since that November debate, Romney has changed his emphasis, saying he was also open to the idea of government guarantees, though not government checks, to help the companies emerge from bankruptcy. Lutz describes himself as a conservative and a Republican, and he's no fan of President Obama. That is, except in the case of the auto rescue.
He just went in and he put the right team together and he got it done. And the results are there for all to see. And I think you have to give credit where credit is due.
And despite his own personal political leanings, Lutz says it's not due to Governor Romney.
I hope he carries Michigan, but to me there's something not quite right about a political system that will rely on modifications of the truth in order to get the political job done.
Another person who was deeply involved in the auto bailout is Stephen Ratner. He was the lead advisor to the president and the Treasury Secretary, also known as the car czar.
Oh, I have seen the quote, yes.
But Ratner isn't sure how Romney can, as the candidate said earlier this week, take a lot of credit for the industry's comeback.
We, of course, had absolutely no contact with him during this. We were unaware of any views he might have had. I know he wrote a piece for the New York Times in 08, but we really hadn't paid any attention to it. So this idea that he now is taking credit for it does boggle the mind.
President Obama this week described this as one of Romney's etch-a-sketch moments. For his part, Romney points back to that 2008 editorial, saying he was right all along. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.
Joining us now is Gregory Zuckerman. He's a special writer for The Wall Street Journal. He's been covering the story since it broke in early April. And Gregory, to start, tell us more about the man who's believed to be at the heart of this, at the $2 billion in losses, known as the London Whale, I hear.
Sure. His name is Bruno Ixell. He's an interesting guy. He lives in Paris, but he commutes to London, wears a lot of black, informal dresser. He comes home, trades from his home in Paris on Fridays, but the rest of the week is in London. And he is one of a group. It's a group called the CIO Group. And frankly, when I started reporting on this, analysts and investors didn't really know much about this group. And the more I uncovered it, the more fascinating it became. They're a group that ostensibly hedges the positions of the bank. So the bank does all these loans and other kinds of things, and the group is charged with protecting and hedging the bank by doing various trades, but it also is charged with making money. So it does things that can potentially be risky at the same time.
So Bruno's reputation as a trader, though, I mean, what kind of guy was he?
Bruno Ixell had been a very successful trader. He made more than $100 million for J.P. Morgan Chase in recent years. He often was able to take advantage of problems in the market. When everyone was selling and panicked, he and the group over there at J.P. Morgan Chase in the London office and elsewhere of the CIO group, they were buying. And they were able to do that because they had the big, huge fortress balance sheet of J.P. Morgan Chase. So Bruno Ixell had been doing quite well. But earlier this year, when he became a little too bullish on the market and on companies, people started calling and wondering about him, and there was a buzz on Wall Street saying he was getting too big and the positions were getting too risky. At the time, J.P. Morgan expressed confidence in the risk management and in Bruno and in his team, but it seems like they didn't do as good a job protecting themselves in this giant group and in Bruno's trades.
So is Bruno Ixell solely to blame for what happened here?
Bruno Ixell is not solely to blame. His superiors knew what he was doing. He's not a rogue trader. That's a point that needs to be underscored here. His bosses knew what he was doing, and his bosses' bosses supposedly knew. At least that's what they told us originally. Now the argument is that they didn't know all the details. But I don't think it's fair to point all the blame at Brunel. There was an issue of risk management. There was an issue of just poor decision-making in the trading side of things. And also just having a group dedicated to both hedging and making money just may not make sense for the largest bank in the country.
Can you explain to us about the issue of oversight? Who was watching these traders then?
Well, it's an interesting group because it's not part of the commercial bank. It's not part of the investment bank. They were self-contained in some ways, and they did have people keeping an eye on them, but they weren't the professionals that do this day-to-day in some of the other areas. And that's frankly what they're doing now. They're bringing in some of the pros from investment banking to clean up the mess.
Gregory, put this in perspective for us in terms of the size of this mistake. We know it's $2 billion and counting in terms of the loss for J.P. Morgan Chase. But this is a bank which once, you know, described its balance sheet as a fortress. So is this just a short-term problem or is it about long-term confidence in the company?
Several billion dollars is significant for J.P. Morgan, but it's not a killer. They made about $19 billion last year, to give you some context. But I do think that the larger issue here is the lack of credibility of the largest bank in the United States. Just a month or so ago, they dismissed the concern that we raised in our story at the Wall Street Journal. And the lack of credibility is something that's going to hurt them going forward, and it's also going to raise the issue of too big to fail. If there is an institution in this country, a financial institution that's too big to fail, it is J.P. Morgan Chase. And this underscores that we as citizens have to be very concerned.
Gregory Zuckerman, thank you for talking with us.
Great to be here.
Gregory Zuckerman is a special writer for The Wall Street Journal.